Again, point of law. Oh, remember that one? How does that date me? Like 100 years ago. We haven't got a quorum yet. So this is an informational hearing anyway, so our quorum is not as important. We don't have a quorum anyway, but I want to welcome you all back. The purpose of today's meeting is to work on two topics. The first one is the most one I want to spend the time on, this choice waiver, and then we're going to spend just a small amount of time just acknowledging the discussions about hospital profits and let people talk about that a little bit. If we run lean on any topic, I'd rather run lean on the hospital profit part, just because I think that the potential of this this choice waiver thing is really quite remarkable. The room is there's a pretty good representation of hospitals and plans and some of the usual attendees in the room, and I appreciate you coming for this. It's have we just, you know, in the conference world, some of you are following our conference committee. Maybe a few of you have a remote interest in that. We expect to meet tonight, sometime this afternoon, today. Christina, tell me when I'm meeting today. Anyway, so, and we plan to wrap that up and move that out of the committee today. So, apparently, we just found this out yesterday ourselves. So, so we're moving along with that. I offered some comments during the conference time, and I'll probably offer some of these same thoughts then. I fully expect when the dust settles, the target we're going to be at is going to resemble the conference target. I do not on earth know how our side is going to yield on the tax issue. I don't see it happening. I do see our side yielding on matters of policy within the bill, on matters of how the targets are apportioned, on matters of, hearings about, whatever, about who gets to be commissioners, on matters of content in the bill, and all those things are open. I see our early MA, how we manage that, as a commentary to work on. So I see lots of areas that could, I see a pathway in my head to an agreement. It resembles kind of the Indiana Jones walk through some of those caves. But I think that level heads can prevail here, and I still remain optimistic something could happen. It's possible it could get done on time, and I would very much like that. The agreements have come together in less time that have been harder than this one would be to get done. I'm just telling you that. That's my view. And so what that means is that the stuff in the conference report is really some pretty meaty stuff for some legacy level reforms. On the healthcare side, we're talking about that today. And the disability management, that's been a different discussion. County services with the tribal piece. Doing things differently to get even better results. I'm convinced we haven't gotten our money's worth in a lot of those areas. And so now the question is, how do you get your money's worth? And just because our target's $1.6 billion or $1.83 billion, however you measure it, all funds, doesn't mean that there's going to be $1.83 billion of lost services going. And I refuse to acknowledge that that is the price tag of having less money. If you've been taking a long way to work and then someone tells you a shortcut and you reduce your driving distance, no one says you caused any harm. And so that's what I'm looking at. And that's what we're looking at today with this. So that's kind of a good preamble for this. And I want to commend the people that have worked on this. And I don't know where this discussion will take us today. And I don't even know how it's going to wind up shaking out, but I'm eager about it. But what I see, to hit our target, or even the target the governor had, if we can reduce the... I need about 10% out of the health care spending as my contribution to the to our target. And then that leaves, so if there's 100%, then the 7% trend, that's 90, that's 107%. And so we reduce that to 97, and then we use all the good tools we have at our disposal. And healthcare homes that we have been told save double digits, CCDSs, which we're told can save over 20%, a certain amount of money going that a plan could count on. Just talked to Alina yesterday. They're in their Coon Rapids site. They're working on more healthcare home stuff. But there's a disincentive. Why would they do that? Because it just reduces their revenue and saves money for me, which is cool. But why would Alina want to do that? And so now if we, with all the tactics we have at our disposal and waiver opportunities we could apply for, if Alina has a pot of money, they'd have every incentive to want to do that. And as I judge, Alina can't really do a lot of risk management, so they need the plans. And they may not have a full network, so they need the plans. And so I see lots of room here. And so if there's a plan that the regular hospitals are protected, the specialty children's hospitals are protected, the HMOs can live with, and the small providers can be engaged in a fair way so they're not carved out, and the FQHC piece is kept intact, you have something that can be just remarkable. And that's what I hope we talk about today. So if they all agree, we can get a new Minnesota Care out of this crisis time that can last 20 more years. The old Minnesota Care was fine. This is not an effort to undo things. It's just a matter of update. So with that, we have some witnesses, and Mr. McAlpin, if you want to come down, and Mr. Skubik, and we have a list of testifiers, and we'll just see where this takes us. And I've been pushing everybody out into the hallways, into rooms, talk to the governor, talk to the administration. And the more we talk together and to everybody and kind of have some good faith and keep engaging people, and people don't just retreat to protect their own turf, we're going to come out of here with something. And that's the point of today, is to get some of that dialogue in public. So with that, I'll stop talking and welcome Mr. McAlpin. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairs and members. For the record, Buck McAlpin, Director of Government Affairs with North Memorial. Probably to put a little framework around where we started, we met early on in session, some of the hospital folks, with Representative Kiffmeyer over some hospital restructuring reform ideas around payment and how we offer services better to the state payer program population. And that was the target that we worked with. As we went through that, it kind of stalled out maybe a month and a half ago. And over the last 3 or 4 weeks, as there was lots of discussion that we felt from the industry, talking to some of our peers around the coordinated care delivery system, although we learned some things in that model, there's still some things that we had grave concern with. Obviously, right now it's $100 million, basically a year in the program, for about 150,000 people, and we had $71 million to care for about 15,000 people, and all of us lost money to care for that. So we sat down a few weeks ago and said, all right, well, we got 2 weeks here, just like you said, Mr. Chair, we can wrap this thing up and come up with some great ideas. And what you had in the choice waiver when it came out is we thought we have to go down two paths. The waiver's an issue, and then how we do something around payment reform, because we thought the two of them mirrored up. So we sat down and designed the color chart I believe you have that talks about provider, patient responsibility, health plan responsibility, and state responsibility. And we won't go into that. I won't go into that with much detail, but we called that the mind map to have a discussion after we saw proposals from many of our peers in the industry like Alina or Essentia or Mayo, as we continued to talk to others about how you could put something together around payment reform. And Mr. Chair, you described it perfectly. Everybody's in a different position. Some of our folks want to do direct contracting. Some of them want to do partial direct contracting. Some of them like the RFP process the state's talking about. Some of them like working with the health plans continually. But the overall message was is that the health plans played a key role in this delivery system of taking care of the state payer population. We have strong relationships with the health plans today, and lots of this stuff we're doing right now in contract. The trick is our discussion went down the line of the structural issue with taking care of the medical assistance state payer program population. Both the Representative Gottwaltz tried to address and others with the voucher system, coordinated care, however we care for the population. As we looked at that, and we visited the last few weeks, lots of things have came up about who fits into this model and who doesn't. Children's hospitals are probably the biggest issue. Dr. Goldblum can talk about that more. Is how do we make sure that we continue to offer specialty care, some of the things that were very tough to do under the CCDS. And as we discussed this, and we met with, we got our finance folks involved the last few weeks, we think we've honed down a little better over what we could work with the health plans. And three big things that I think we have common ground with, and they'll testify from the plans, is around data. What data do we need to share to be sure that we can actually reduce costs and start to make structural changes to the payment model and actually turn the curve down like we started to with the CCDs and what many of our peers in the industry and the health plans are doing now around care coordination. Gain sharing, something for success. So you just hit it on the head, Mr. Chair, that if Allina's doing something up in Anoka, Coon Rapids, that they're decreasing costs, what incentive do they have to continue to drive that cost down working with their health plan provider? And patient assignment. And we feel that's where the waiver fits into this. There is some things that the plans can do, but the one thing that I think is the overall glaring thing we learned from CCDs is when we actually reached out, got a hold of patients, and assigned them to a primary care provider and made sure that we coordinated their care, we did change the cost curve. Now, how do we expand that to 600,000-800,000 people in state government payer programs? And hopefully with that, that type of care coordination grows to folks that are in the private market. We want them to be just as healthy as we look at that. A recent report from the insurance industry I was just reading that says uninsured folks literally across the country do not pay their hospital bills. So anything that we can do to be sure people stay insured and that we don't cost shift the uninsured population to the small business market is what we want to look at. Because I think our fear is we'll be back here again for the next budget after you guys get through this one, and we don't want to come back and say we're $2 billion short again in health and human services. I think the argument amongst you guys as legislators will be, do we take the early MA, obviously from the hospital association and from our hospital and everyone we've worked with, we think early MA is a big part of this model. You cannot carve this much money out of the system right now and not have a massive cost shift to small business. So we're trying to come up with some ideas that put that together to help you, Mr. Chair and members, actually put something around payment reform. One thing we did add in the bill that is the 10% PMAP reduction, the target that you asked about to come up with some money, because we feel working with the health plans on some of the gain sharing, we can capture some of that back and try to decrease the cost to the state. And if we put something we felt structurally together, we hope it helps. And I know we've talked to Representative Huntley about this before, all the great things that hospitals have done, and we haven't captured that savings in state fiscal notes. And I couldn't imagine where we'd be today if many of the providers from FQHCs all the way up to hospitals hadn't been doing some care planning the last 4, 5, 6, 7 years. We'd probably have a much worse target than we have today on state payer programs. So with that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Skubic, and after that, Mr. Chair, we can talk about some of the ideas around what we've put together.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Mark Skubic. I'm the Vice President of Public Policy at Park Nicollet Health Services. As we had discussed and as the Chair Abler had commented on earlier, the biggest challenge you have right now, I think, is that your target simply is too big for the Health and Human Services budget, and it creates a bigger challenge for you. And I don't envy you your position, but what we're trying to do here is come up with a softer glide path for a landing so that we can preserve what we've achieved in Minnesota and protect people from losing health care coverage. We know there's going to be cuts in the budget, but what we're looking for here and what we're hoping will stimulate a conversation around some alternative ways that we can maybe look at how to do payment reform so that we can avoid the kind of cuts to coverage and other negative impacts that that's the size of a cut will have on the healthcare system. These cuts do impact all Minnesota residents. So one thing we've understood as a result of the last economic downturn is when we cut services or we cut programs, it doesn't just impact low income, it impacts the entire community, and we're hoping to find a way to avoid those kinds of outcomes. One of the things I like to focus on, a couple things here, and create some context for what Mr. McAlpin presented. We know from state government program experience in the past that employers end up getting cost shifted to when the state underpays for state programs. What we've seen recently, just to give you an example at Park Nicollet, we did an analysis that if we were to take all of our patients and assume that all of them got paid at Medicaid rates, we would lose $300 million a year. And on the converse, if all of our patients were paid at commercial rates, we would profit by $257 million a year. Now, for an organization like ours that is $1 billion, that's a $500 million swing. But more importantly, what it shows is that in just the size of the cost shift to the commercial market that's created by the continued cuts in healthcare, and that's why we're trying to find alternative ways to deal with the budget deficit than just do cuts. What we also experienced in the most recent round of budget challenges from the economic downturn is we had a number of people who were laid off in Minnesota in the healthcare industry, so we've lost jobs, and we're a little bit concerned that the size of these cuts could lead in the same direction. And what eventually ends up happening is providers will look to reduction in non-contributing services to their operations. I'd like to point to two states just to show you examples of how things are being addressed, and you're not alone as legislators from the state of Minnesota in dealing with some pretty tough challenges. If you look at the state of Texas, who has had a very high rate of uninsured, part of the reaction that the healthcare market had to that high rate of uninsurance, because those costs still exist in the healthcare system and they get cost shifted, is they've actually closed ICU beds, they've closed emergency departments, and it's that kind of approach that we would like to avoid. Ironically, under the federal reform law, Texas probably stands to benefit the most of a lot of states because their rate of uninsured is so high. And that's a challenge we've always had with the disparity in payments and funding at the federal level for many, many years. So that's the situation in Texas. I'd like to point to comments recently made as well by Governor Scott Walker in Wisconsin. He was recently speaking at an advocacy day in Wisconsin and had two comments I'd like to just point out. And it kind of supports and identifies what we're trying to accomplish with this proposal we're bringing forward. His first comment, he said, we need to provide for the people in need, but we need to do it in a way that makes sense, which I think we would all agree with. And second, he said, other states have looked at things like changing the reimbursement rates for medical providers, and for him, that is not an option in Wisconsin. It just gets passed on. It's just a hidden tax on employers. And I think we can align things a little better through a proposal like this to try to avoid that continued cost shift. So the cuts not only affect in this budget that you're dealing with, that do have the potential for some profound impact on things like population health, our ability to maintain or to improve the health of our population across all payers and across all regions of the state. We will have a harder time meeting the unmet needs and focus on prevention. There are higher emergency department costs.
Yeah, just if you can just kind of look forward, I know all the problems we got, so we're already depressed as it is. So if you can just kind of like look at the opportunity and how we can maybe get out of this alive. thanks, just to push you on it.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. So what we're trying to do with this proposal is focus on what Minnesota accomplishments have been made. And I look back to the Governor Plenty's Transformation Task Force in 2007. And some of you were familiar with the proposals that came out of that task force report. And frankly, you've adopted some of those proposals that I think give us an opportunity in the context of what's being proposed here. First of all is the success of healthcare homes in Minnesota. We've seen in the commercial market and in some Medicare products that those healthcare home innovations have shown positive signs of reducing or bending the cost curve. I think focusing on what we've accomplished here and the legislature has done here would be one tool that would be important to achieving these cost reductions. The second thing we did in the 2008 reform law was to begin to create measures around total cost of care, which is going to be important for you as legislators to have to be able to gauge where reform is moving forward. The third piece, however, that three-legged stool that we have not yet accomplished is payment reform, and that's why we're bringing this proposal forward and why we think this could help you accomplish your budget goals. So we're trying to build on the strengths of Minnesota's success. We have a tremendous healthcare system in Minnesota. It's recognized nationally as being a very high quality, efficient state, and that's to the benefit, to the, it's actually a tribute to all the providers in the state of Minnesota who have accomplished that. So we look forward to working with you on this proposal and think that this is a much better solution. I know it's been a challenge for you. We're just trying to bring something forward that gives an alternative way to deal with the problem we have.
I appreciate that. Any questions for the witnesses? Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Skubuck or Mr. McAlpine, one of the things in the conference committee report is getting rid of pay for performance, which was one of the 2008 reviews. Is that a plus or a minus, do you think?
Mr. Skubuck.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley. One of the challenges I think we have in this state is we have a very disparate healthcare system. Some organizations are more prepared to go to a total cost of care type of payment model. Others aren't yet there, and some haven't even begun to think about that. So pay for performance is a tool that can be used to help providers to learn to get to where you eventually want them to go. So we've actually, with a lot of our health plan contracts in the commercial and Medicare market, have focused on pay for performance measures. And those measures really focus on the improvement of quality, which we know also creates efficiency.
And but I want to keep this discussion going forward. We're having a conference committee later. We can talk about those. And I don't want to cut you off. If you want to talk about something about the prospective thing, Representative Huntley. I'm hoping you're going to help on this prospective thing.
Well, and Mr. Chair, you talked about Harrison Ford and Indiana Jones, and I think we're in the pit with all the snakes.
It's a scary place to be. And I'll leave it. I'm not sure where you're going with the snake thing. But well, let's bring some more folks down here. And
Mr. Chair?
Oh, yeah, sorry. Hi.
Thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Could I ask a question, please?
Yes.
Thank you.
I didn't see you behind me.
Yeah, that's okay. Good morning. I have a question for Mr. McAlpin. And I was just looking again at the summaries of the four hospitals that participated in the CCDS system. And one of the hallmarks that I recall from your descriptions of what happened over the 9 months was that you tiered the patients. And the tier one patients, those that were most frequently presenting in the ER, got the most intensive care coordination, and that's one of the places where you saw the greatest cost savings. Is that an accurate description of the experience at North?
Mr. Kaufman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I think the one thing we did at North different from the other CCDSs is we opened up six of our primary care clinics where the other ones had a central site for them and then got them into primary care. So we tried to get them, the day it started, we reached out to our enrolled population and got them right away an appointment in primary care. And we think that was the major driver that kept them out of the ER, is right away we reached out and grabbed them and figured out within just a few weeks that it was not, most of this was not a medical problem, it was a social or a caseworker type problem dealing with people with mental health, alcohol abuse, or other type of social issues.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Murphy.
And Mr. McAlpin, I think we've been over this territory a lot, and we understand for a number of those served in the public programs, especially those, least able to afford the choices they would have to make on their own, that is the root problem, right, that they have a combination of physical illness and some social issues that need, they need guidance to navigate that. So when I think about those tiered individuals, I wonder how they fall in this proposal in terms of what the system, the hospital, the CCDS cost was, and where that intersects with the stop loss threshold in your proposal. Do you? Can you give me any advice on that?
Mr. McAlpin.
Sure, Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy. Actually, leaving the health plans in this, we figured that there's work with them. Talking to DHS, I believe the health plans do a lot of the stop-loss high-end side of it. And our CEO from North probably says this best. Right now, today, we absolutely assume all kinds of risks. Every time somebody walks into our emergency room, we just had a level 3 newborn baby that had about $1.7 million in charges, and I believe we got $26,000 for medical assistance. So how we plug folks into that is, I think once we get them into primary care and care coordinate them, and there's just some population it's going to be very tough to care coordinate with. Some of the discussions we've had with Gillette and Minneapolis Children's over very surgical-type-based stuff. But I think we have to try to move as much of this population to a primary care relationship as we can.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Thank you,
sure.
Mr. Chair.
Maybe
just
more.
A couple
yeah.
more questions. Mr. McAlpin, I think it would be helpful, at least for me, and this is for the other CCDS folks in the room, if we could have some concrete figure to help us understand the top-tier enrollees and where the threshold is in relationship to the stop loss, so we understand who's holding which risk and what that means for the impact on state budget going forward. I have had a chance to look at this. You know, you're making progress in terms of fleshing it out, but it's still pretty conceptual. So I think that for me would be one important question to understand where the risk rests across the multiple, you know, the hospitals and the primary care clinics and the state and the health plans, just understanding that more concretely would help me. And then just one final question. As I listened to the folks who participated in the CCDS over the 9 months that we did that, it seemed like each tiered their patients, and the greatest savings were with the sickest patients. So I think it will be helpful for the committee and those who are going to be participating in this going forward to understand the trajectory of savings, because I don't think as we move into the healthier populations, and you can see where they are in the public programs, but the savings are going to be so great, and we shouldn't overestimate those savings. And then my question is, would we need a waiver from Medicaid to enact the delivery system changes that you're describing here or that we experienced with the CCDS?
Good question, Mr. McAlpin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, we're not sure. And we actually, I believe, in our final, this last draft, this is draft 7, we joked the community paramedic took us 19 drafts to get there, so you're right, still a work in progress. We don't know for sure if it even requires a waiver. We'd sure appreciate the input from DHS. We've been speaking with them and the health plans on that. I think there's lots of things the plans can help us with that. And then stepping back to your last question, I think I know where you're going with the tiered part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we did tier, and I'm off a few, but out of our 2,500 enrollees at North, we identified about 60 of them that were our high-cost utilizers that took up the majority of our cost. And I believe if working with the health plans on good data and tracking, if we can track those are numbers that we want to get at to book savings for the state long-term, not just 2 weeks from now.
Thank you, Mr. McAlpin.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Person, help me, and then I'd like to move on to some witnesses.
Mr. Chair and Mr. McAlpin, currently we're spending on the CCDS population with early MA, we're spending about $1.8 billion of state and federal money, and it looks like we're going to spend about $300 million, which is an 82% cut. Can you also show us how you're going to save 82% of the cost of these people?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, it's not an item you make it up in volume, that's for sure. We lost about, on just cost, North lost about $9 million to care for the CCD population over that period. That's why I think that the industry will always say we support early MA enrollment. The last numbers I've saw calculated was about $660 a year per enrollee under the current CCD model that's been proposed in the conference committee report. That doesn't even cover one ambulance trip a year for our system. So absolutely, we look forward to continued discussion about how we keep more money in the system.
Thanks. So let's take some more witnesses. And, you know, this is not the conference committee. This is a this is a finance committee talking about another ways to perspective look forward. That's should we take Dr. Goldblum? Okay, you want to come down, Dr. Goldblum? And then maybe Jonathan Watson can come sit next to him, and we'll just kind of move down our list here. This is really hard. I respect that. This is there's lots of pieces here. And Dr. Goldblum, welcome to committee. And what's on your mind today?
Thank you very much for the opportunity, Mr. Chair. I represent, for the record, I'm Alan Goldblum. I'm the president and CEO of Children's Hospitals and Clinics of Minnesota, which includes both Children's Minneapolis and Children's St. Paul. We're an organization of 340 beds and about 4,300 employees, and the 10th largest children's hospital in the nation. And what I'd like to do, and I expect to confine my remarks to 5 minutes, Mr. Chair, is just make a couple of comments about our observations of the proposals that are coming forward, the impact that it may have on children in this state, and some suggestions. Certainly, the Minnesota Choice Plan does have a lot of positives about it when applied, especially to organizations that are able to provide the full spectrum of care, from primary care to complex care. And that's a situation that many of our adult hospitals are in a position to do. However, the unique characteristics of a referral children's hospital, such as ours, such as Gillette, don't easily fit into this model. Both Gillette and Children's are freestanding, independent children's hospitals. We're not affiliated with any larger systems. Moreover, in any given year, we see kids from every system in the state and from every county in the state, not just the metro area. We see them for their leukemia, for their open heart surgery, or for their 2 months stay in a neonatal intensive care unit. And then we return them to their original caregivers, who may be at quite a distance. It's not a single definable network. The children's hospitals will need to be treated separately so that we can find a mechanism that mandates access to and reasonable payment for unique pediatric services, regardless of where those kids happen to get their primary care. The resources of our hospital and of any specialty hospital have to be available, as they are today. In 2010, just for example, we saw kids from every single county in the state of Minnesota, not to mention 60% of the counties of the surrounding states, and were the single largest provider of care for kids with cancer, heart defects, complex surgical conditions, and so forth. The other issue is that for the last several years, the children's hospitals have been the recipients of the most disproportionate cuts in the state. Why? Because in our case, 42% of our revenue comes from Medicaid. If you compare that to the average adult hospital, and there are some differences, the average adult hospital is 5 to 10% of their revenue. So imagine if you have a rate cut, a 1%, 2% rate cut, the impact on children's is four times greater than on most of the adult hospitals in the state, and yet we're being asked to provide some of the highest cost services. And that means that every time the rates are cut or rebasing is delayed, we have that impact. And I will just add, Mr. Chair, that with all the recent talk in the news about hospital margins, and any impression that, well, we can absorb this, in 2010, the margin at Children's was 0.4%. And for the current year, 2011, we are hoping to get to break even, and we think the way things are going, that is going to be a challenge. So I would ask the committee to consider a couple things. First of all, Medicaid, as we know it, is commonly thought of as insurance for the poor. Remember that Medicaid is also the single largest insurer of children in this country. And the irony is that while children are 50% of Medicaid recipients in the country, they account for only 18% of the costs. And frankly, when you're spending the health care dollar, there isn't a greater return on investment than investing in kids. It's a return that lasts for 70 or 80 years. Not that I have any objection to spending it on the elderly. I'm rapidly approaching that age group and will want care when I get there. The other reminder I'd give the committee is that the early enrollment in Medicaid that the governor has proposed does not benefit kids. Remember that what that allowed was for early enrollment of adults. So I want to finish with three simple messages. First, if ultimately we adopt a program like Minnesota Choice or some variant thereof, it's going to be essential that the program ensure access to specialized pediatric services when needed, either by ensuring that the children's hospitals are part of every such network, because we can't be defined as belonging to a single geographic area, or by carving out the funding for children's hospitals separate from these networks and ensuring that that funding is sufficient to continue to provide those services. So it's not only access, and again, there may be many of these networks set up around the state if this catches on. We need to be accessible to every single one of them, and there needs to be a mechanism to ensure appropriate funding. Second, if we are carved out, and if you will, left on our own with fee-for-service Medicaid or PMAP, then it's going to be essential that any cuts to those programs exempt the children's hospitals, those that are most dependent on those programs for their revenue. And I want to express my appreciation of the fact that the committee thus far, in the language of the legislation, does exempt the children's hospitals from those further cuts. Finally, I want to say that we have been and we continue to be open to models of payment reform and in taking on increased risk ourselves. Indeed, we are making some proposals to the Department of Human Services for models of increased risk assumption. But ultimately, the fundamental resource of preserving an outstanding children's hospital for the state is going to have to be protected. There will be news release today that U.S. News and World Report will issue its annual rating of children's hospitals, and once again we will be in there among the top in the country. We were two of only seven children's hospitals listed by Leapfrog, two of seven in the country, as the top children's hospitals in the country. Leapfrog is the organization associated here with the Buyers Healthcare Action Group, which rates hospitals on quality and on safety. So with those caveats, Mr. Chair, we're ready to play the game, and we want to be at the table, but we feel it's essential that the resource be protected for the whole state, that it be protected with an appropriate funding mechanism, recognizing that there's a filtration system that sends the sickest and often most costly kids to one or two hospitals in the metro area, and we do serve the whole state. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. We've accumulated a quorum. We'll come to order officially. Representative Gottwald moves the minutes. Discussion about that. Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you very much. Mr. Watson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name, for the record, is Jonathan Watson. I'm the Public Policy Director with the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers. Those are the FQHCs in the state. We serve about 186,000 patients statewide, their primary care, medical, mental health, and dental needs. So today my purpose is to have some comments on the choice proposal as I've seen it evolve here. But let me first state that our association is very supportive of any models, payment reform, any sort of reform that sustains existing benefits and eligibility levels for our folks on Minnesota healthcare programs. We are in agreement with the intent and the goals of the legislation as it's stated, specifically a person-centered system that relies on care coordination. So the basis I'm speaking from today, I guess, is two PowerPoint presentations I've seen on this in the past, as well as seven different language versions that have been drafted in the conference committee report as well. So if it's scattered, that's my rationale for it. So I'm going to divide my comments briefly into two areas, the macro level and the micro level. Starting with the macro level, and these are from some of the language I've seen on PowerPoint presentations where there's reference to Medicaid block grants. I have to come out pretty strongly opposed to the block grant of the Medicaid program for the state of Minnesota. Medicaid is a vital revenue source for community health centers. Roughly 40% of our patients are on Medicaid, and it's correspondingly about 40% of our revenue. As an aside, we do serve about 10.3% of your non-disabled Medicaid enrollees, but we only take about 1.4% of your spending. So it's a fantastic return on investment for the state. But nonetheless, a block grant would really have a devastating impact on community health centers. Specifically, the level of funding, obviously, we're concerned about if a block grant went to occur, especially in the out years. The Kaiser Foundation earlier this week released a report about the impact in terms of eligibility of numbers of people under a block grant proposal that's being considered under Representative Paul Ryan's plan in the U.S. Congress. And for Minnesota, projected between almost 189,000 folks, upwards of 445,000 folks would lose coverage. Again, we're an access point for the uninsured. We think a lot of those folks would use a community health center and would just increase the number of uninsured requesting services at a health center, which already goes up 11% every year. So you're probably never going to hear this, never will again in St. Paul, but Medicaid really is our favorite, best, and most reliable payer. That's the world of the FQHC. You probably don't hear that often. So nonetheless, it's vital that we keep that revenue stream for community health centers in order to have the funding necessary to serve all 186,000 patients that we serve of all payer sources. The second macro level observation I have is, I guess, confusion, which isn't surprising, I guess, from our perspective, but in terms of where we're headed with the choice versus the accountable care organization efforts at the Department of Human Services, our community health centers are engaged under the ACO model. In terms of the RFI, we responded to that, and we're looking forward to replying to the RFP. They're meeting every Tuesday in my office. I have to buy them coffee, so I know this, but they're very engaged, and we're just trying to get the signal straight in terms of how we're proceeding here, so to devote our best efforts, because we really do want to be in the driver's seat in terms of elevating primary care and care coordination. So those are my two macro-level observations. I do have six real brief micro-level observations, if you will. The first one being, and we've talked about this occasionally, is just the level of risk that FQHCs can afford to take on under any sort of shared savings approach. Our profit margins, I think we have positive profit margins when there's a lunar eclipse, so they're very, very slim. And so it doesn't really allow us to take on a lot of risk. Our profitability is just non-existent in a sense. The second observation is the amount of the payment between the choice plan and the individual network providers. There was some language in there about the per member per month. We just need to sit down and evaluate how that per member per month rate goes against our existing reimbursement methodology. There's a lot of unknowns out there, so this is just kind of my raising a flag on that issue. The third is there is some language in there about risk adjustment, and we've been frustrated in some sense about current risk adjustment efforts that only look at insurance status of patients. It does talk about the health acuity of each particular enrollee, but we'd like a more robust risk adjustment measure that also looks at ethnicity, language, income and poverty, homelessness, other social factors that really play into a person's access and their ability to, or their outcomes in terms of health care. The fourth piece is just kind of we're still a little scarred from the CCDS experiment that occurred. We did have some patients that really lost access to community health centers that they've been using for years. So patient assignment, patient attribution is a big issue for us. We want to have those folks who have chosen a community health center as their medical home for years to remain with the community health center. Unfortunately, that didn't occur in some instances under the CCDS program, so we just want to head that off at the pass at this moment. The last two, real briefly, is care coordination, I guess in my opinion, really relies on the exchange of information using technology, and there is language in here to continually improve technology, but I don't think we're at the interoperable stage yet in the state of Minnesota, so the ability of a community health center to speak with the hospital, to speak with specialists, to see if tests were performed, what the results of those tests were, whether our patients were in the ER four times in the last week, I don't think we're at that stage, and some investments need to be made in order to gain that discussion from a technology perspective. And lastly, the proposal does speak to needed services, making sure particular enrollees have needed services. I would strongly recommend upping that definition a little bit to make sure we include the mental health needs and the oral health services that patients do need, because that is part of the person's overall health. And I just think it would be more appropriate to make that an explicit expectation. So in summary, we do understand that the status quo is going to translate into benefits and eligibility cuts, which means more uninsured at a community health center. So we are very excited to partner with the folks who are developing the choice proposal here, and we're also working again with the department on the ACO RFP RFI process as well. So hopefully today my purpose was threefold: to voice my opposition to the block grants, to talk about, secondly, kind of our confusion of where things are going with the ACO and the choice network, and then lastly just some minor tweaks that we'd like to see in the legislation. And I would assure you all that we're willing to work with pretty much anyone to make sure the FQHCs are part of the safety net and part of this system as it evolves. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Mr. Watson. Appreciate coming in. From my view, and I just think that you're a very lean, effective model. And whereas some systems don't get an incentive to coordinate, you have every incentive to do it and to make sure it's targeted and effective. So, and that's why you're here, and that's why your every sentence I say, I include you in your name just as the icon of what you represent. Mm-hmm. So that's my interest in this. Rep. Sangalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Watson, thank you for your testimony. We've talked before about some reform ideas around special needs populations, and appreciate everything that the FQHCs do here in the state of Minnesota, often with limited resources. I'm going to ask you a question that I think I'll perhaps ask other testifiers to address as well, and that is, the concept of the block grant around MA is designed to take the funds that we're currently receiving from the federal government and allow for some flexibility in how those funds are used. I heard you say you're opposed to block grant because it would throw hundreds of thousands of people off of coverage, and I'm not understanding how, if you receive the same money but get to use it differently, that de facto results in people losing coverage. Can you help me understand that?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Cowalt, I wasn't very clear in my explanation, but the Kaiser Foundation did look out to the year 2021 in terms of they expected that was the end result by 2021. Those numbers of folks would lose eligibility. And I think the issue, what they're looking at, is they're saying that you're going to get the same amount of funds in the first year, but they're only inflating the block grant by the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, which is average over the last 10 years about 2.3%. And as we all know, healthcare inflation is a lot higher than that, and that's why we need to change all this, frankly. But I think there's just that gap in the out years and 10 years out is the Kaiser's methodology for that study.
So, Mr. Chair and Mr. Wise, it's really about the revenue stream drying up in a sense. Okay, I understand that, but I really hope we're seeing an opportunity here. I mean, I've heard it from so many people, from administration, from members of the DFL caucus, from members of our caucus, obviously, that if we relieved ourselves of some of the federal requirements that get in the way right now, Minnesota knows how to care for special needs populations. You people in particular, FQHCs, I think, know exactly how to do this better. And if we have the dollars flow to that, especially Representative Huntley in the past has talked about the need to move dollars upstream, more primary care, more preventive care with these populations, we can do a much better job caring for them first and foremost, but then also save some money as well. And so I just hope we speak to some of that as we hear testimony today.
Great. And just I have one more question, and we'll keep, unless there's questions. To the two groups here, the children's and FQHCs, do you cross refer at all, or are your populations entirely different? Just in terms of interaction of your random.
There's certainly some overlap because many children with mental health problems find their way to access care first through a children's emergency room, actually. And there's a significant number who come into us. We don't have dedicated inpatient services for mental health. We do have outpatient services for mental health. I know the University of Minnesota has a large inpatient mental health facility for adolescents. So there are some, and there is some crossover, but that's a small portion.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. All right. Well, that's fine. Any questions? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Watson. I am wondering if you can help me understand if we were to significantly cut your rates, if you would be able to do a better job of coordinating the care for the sickest people in your population.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative Murphy, it would be a continued struggle. Again, the Medicaid, as I referred, I was being completely serious that it is our best and most reliable payer. It is truly the lifeblood and the backbone of our community health center. If those rates are cut, again, it is our mission to serve all regardless of their ability to pay, but just the level of services, the availability, the weekend hours would have to scale back from, staff would be have to lay it off. You also look at some of your high-cost areas as well, dental being one of those. I think dental services would suffer in particular if our rates were cut.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr.
Just
Chair.
We're trying to look forward here.
I know.
I mean, this is a,
this
meant
is
to be
important.
A little island in the middle of a little interesting time we're having. So, go ahead.
Island,
Representative Murphy.
Snake pit, you know, whatever. I understand we're trying to move forward, but I think we have to move forward with our eyes open, right?
I'm with you.
I know. So if we were to eliminate eligibility for a population that you serve, would that make it easier for you, or would you do a better job of coordinating care?
Mr. Watts.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, we would have no choice but to coordinate care better. It's called survival. That's how we survive as long as we have, as we try to keep those folks healthy, and that means they're coming to the community health center less often. So we try to, their health and things we do to promote that would force us to, and again, you're kind of stuck in terms of with less revenue, the ability to coordinate diminishes, so it's a fine line there that you have to strike. So I can't give you a direct answer in terms of a yes or no, because it's a difficult question to answer.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Watson, it sounds to me like you're suggesting if we cut eligibility significantly, you can do a better job. Is that accurate?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, no, that is not accurate.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. Representative Slavik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was reflecting on the comments by Dr. Goldblum and about Children's Hospital and ensuring access to specialized pediatric services and how important that is. And as we know, I work on early childhood issues, little kid issues, same principle, although we're investing here at the state in closing the achievement gap. I mean, you're investing in saving lives and continuing lives. Mr. Chair, I think my question is probably more for you. He talked about, you know, the different options for children's hospitals, including making sure you carve them out. And I wondered if there's been a lot of discussion about that, and if you're going to keep children's hospitals treat them in a different way because of the unique issues that they have.
Well, thanks for asking. And that's the whole point of this meeting. And I don't know what the final version looks like. And just, you know what, this is kind of a novel approach. About a lot of times these deals are kind of done by the governor comes out with a plan or the department, or we're kind of developing a legislative thing. And it's Mr. Watson kind of commented that there's a department activity toward kind of a paced version toward this, and this is a legislative approach trying to push the department and the governor and the plans and the different providers while preserving access. And this is, I'm gathering information, and as sounds like we all are here. And so I think that the emphasis, even in the conference report, we did have some language to protect them, just to single them out as different. I think we'd better protect these services. So I think we probably agree on that. Does that help?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that's what I hope we do. I mean, I hope that there's a way for children to stay engaged through the process and stay engaged with us. As we know, we're kind of in the countdown here, but we may be in this conversation for a little while longer than that. And then, Mr. Chair, I hope oftentimes I'm not in the room either, you know, at the end. But you might be there. So
maybe.
Hopefully you can continue to keep that in mind. It's really important.
Yeah, point noted. Well, thank you. Let's take Ms. Rolanda Mason, and then we'll have the health plans come down. And is anybody else who would like to comment about this yet today? It's not on the list that didn't get signed up, just so I can plan our time. Okay, well, welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rolanda Mason. I am with Legal Aid. Legal Aid represents low-income people across the state of Minnesota, and most of the people that we represent receive their health care through either medical assistance or Minnesota Care. We support reforms that focus on care coordination We believe that if it's done well, a patient-centered care coordination approach will improve outcomes and reduce costs. But we think that it has to be done deliberately and collaboratively. This current plan, as we've seen the PowerPoints and a couple of the versions of the draft, seems to be weak on details, and so it's hard for us to judge where it's going to go. We're not really sure what the point is of this right now. If it is if this is designed to start a dialogue, and Chairman Abler, you've spoken several times about wanting to start a dialogue on these issues. If that's the purpose of this choice proposal language that we've seen, is to start that dialogue with the intent to allow all stakeholders, including enrollees, to participate over the next several months as we talk about a fundamental redesign of this program, then that's something that we support and we would look forward to participating in. But if this is intended to rush us towards a major revision of the delivery system without enrollee input, then we would strongly oppose it. We think that, as I've said, this is a major overhaul of the delivery system for public programs. And to achieve the outcomes that we hope for that have been discussed here, we think it has to work for everyone. It has to work for providers. It has to work for the agency that administers it. But most importantly, it has to work for the enrollees who will receive their health care from it. So we would ask that as we move forward, that we do so bringing all the stakeholders to the table, making sure that enrollee input is front and center in the discussions as we move forward. Thank you.
Well, thank you. That's helpful. And I hope you see this as being a collaborative sort of a thing. And I think all the input is welcome and sought. So I don't know the best way for enrollees to input about this. I would suspect they have a state representative and have a pretty good cross section of those on this committee. They would. So if you have ways that we can engage them, please let me know.
Certainly.
Okay. You want to come down and then we'll take the plans after you. So Dr. Sawyer. And then, well, there's two of you to come down. So. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Charles Sawyer, and I'm a chiropractic doctor and senior vice president at Northwestern Health Sciences University in Bloomington. We train chiropractic doctors, massage therapists, and acupuncturists. Have clinics throughout the Twin Cities and conduct research that is predominantly federally funded and focuses primarily on looking at the effectiveness of chiropractic and other forms of care in very complicated randomized clinical trials involving hundreds of patients. I have an interest in this topic today because clearly, I think we all agree that the system that we're in, particularly that providers are in, and that purchasers provide care for, is fractured on a good day, probably. The care is far less coordinated as it might be, and frankly, going forward, needs to be. We spend plenty of money. A shortage of that is not the problem. What is the most significant concern is the fractured and inefficient system that we are all in, and the state has a significant interest in that because of the challenge of providing quality care for an increasing number of low-income Minnesotans. Things that we think about a lot are best practices in terms of bringing the right provider at the right time for the right patient, and how that can increase efficiency, bring the outcomes at a higher level, and decrease cost. So I want to just take a minute and share with you just a few thoughts in a very brief period of time about musculoskeletal health problems. Back pain, neck pain, headache, and that whole constellation of clinical conditions that fall into the musculoskeletal category are very common, and they're very costly. And they're often overlooked as a public health problem. Depending on how you add up the nature of conditions that people bring to healthcare providers, back pain in adults is either the second or third most common reason for seeking healthcare of any kind. The direct costs for care are significant. And the indirect costs of having those conditions is also considerable in terms of loss of productivity and basically being out of the game. Chiropractic doctors are increasingly being seen by patients with back, neck, and headache pain. And they are also being sought after for clinical problems that may not have been addressed effectively by their care providers. So it's not just limited to musculoskeletal problems, but that is predominantly the constellation of conditions for which we're most highly trained, and the literature is showing we're the most effective. The effectiveness of chiropractic care from a clinical standpoint is very well established. And increasingly, there are studies that are showing that it's cost-effective, particularly when patients with back and neck pain get to a chiropractic doctor first. Several major and very convincing studies have been published just within the last 2 years, for example, including and most especially a claims analysis research study done in Tennessee where care is not managed. This was done by a very reputable research organization that demonstrated in the analysis of hundreds of thousands of insurance claims through Blue Cross Blue Shield that if patients saw chiropractic doctors first for back pain, neck pain, and headache, as opposed to seeking care predominantly or first from primary care medical physicians, the costs at the end were anywhere from 20 to 40% lower. Very large cohort of patients, and a very eloquent claims analysis, and probably the most natural experiment you can imagine, where none of it was managed. So the cost data are beginning to catch up with the evidence that chiropractic care is efficacious for back and neck pain. But here's the problem. We are still largely outside the system. To take advantage of what the literature is showing in terms of both clinical effectiveness and increasingly cost effectiveness, we need to be into the health reform conversation, including the payment reform conversation. If payment is moving away from reimbursement based on procedures and more toward paying for value and compensating care providers more, particularly when they are together in a group, compensating them in a different fashion, chiropractic care can add value to both the patient and the system if we are together with other care providers, primary care MD physicians, nurse practitioners, and specialists to re-engineer care. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we would welcome the opportunity to partner with organizations that have an intent and enough will, frankly, to re-engineer the system, bringing providers from a variety of disciplines together to coordinate care in a more effective fashion and to design care so that we achieve higher outcomes and lower costs.
Thank you. Any questions for the witness? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have a question, but I think this is a really important point. And as we talk about wanting to change the way care is paid for and delivered, this topic that the testifier is touching on is one we haven't spent much time on. It's pretty important in terms of the idea of reengineering care delivery moving forward. We know what happened in Massachusetts because they moved coverage first and not the payment or delivery reform, and it resulted in a shortage of providers. So I think, you know, we've been trying to move the payment side, the changes and the care delivery changes first. As we look at the access side of the equation, trying to take our reform in Minnesota in a different direction. But this piece about the providers has been, I think, relegated to the side, and we're going to have to tend to that pretty soon. Thank you.
Well, it's on my mind, too. And I think the point Dr. Sawyer brings is, I've seen it in my professional world a lot, that collaboration is the best. The right provider at the right time, coordinating without ego or, you know, other reasons to want to limit care that should be given is the best way. And in all this, I think that, you know, the focus, if our focus is on the patient and the client, then how those providers interact and how we pay them and how the big plans and the big hospitals and small plans and different hospitals work. You hope and, you know, that in truth and stuff works out. But a good point, so thank you. Thanks, Dr. Sloan.
Thank you.
I wanted to, Jeff and Lynn, do you want to come down? I think this is productive. I'm really glad for the participation of all the different entities. And we could hear from the MMA talking about what their concerns are about some of the same. I think Dr. Sawyer is represents some of the concerns they would have about access and so on. But to a whole different angle, Mr. Barsh and Ms. Nelson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Lynn Nelson, and I represent Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota and the 2.7 million members we have across all 87 counties. Today, I'm speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans and the seven nonprofit health plans in Minnesota. Thank you for this opportunity to testify in the choice waiver. We understand and recognize the state's long-term budget challenges and understand that status quo is not an option. Last week, the health plans had a very productive meeting with the hospitals, as Mr. McAlpin said. And we did agree, some general agreement on components of the total cost of care proposal that would establish a reformed healthcare delivery system for state public programs by expanding the use of payment reform models and other techniques that are already being used successfully in the private commercial market. These 3 points are very much in line with Mr. McAlpin's point, which is progress. That's great progress. First, require enrollment assignment or patient assignment, as he indicated. This would require enrollees to select a total cost of care provider in order to receive services. It would also require the commissioner to request a waiver and implement any state plan amendments. Second, collaborate with the providers to analyze and share data on utilization on claims for health services and supporting providers to manage these populations. This would help to identify some of the high-cost enrollees and some of the things that Mr. McAlpin had indicated. Third, incent the providers by sharing with them the variations that result in the cost and quality of care in state public programs. To the third point, the health plans are really moving forward with new arrangements with providers in the commercial market. And for example, Blue Cross is strongly committed to our new provider partnerships, which involve the health plan and provider in assuring high quality care and bending the cost curve. Our aligned incentives contract take into consideration the health of our members while changing the payment systems and methodologies, rewarding those who deliver value. As you can see in the graphic, and I think you have a color version of this in front of you. The new payment model consists of 3 components, a fee-for-service agreement, a total cost of care incentive, and a quality incentive. And those change over a period of 3 years. And we're also trying to extend our contracts from 1 year to 3 years so that we're not in a constant state of negotiation, which also provides some value and consistency. We are interested in exploring efforts to integrate state public programs into these arrangements, and we hope that we are provided the flexibility and opportunities for our models to evolve in this direction. We have presented this to CMS and to other states, and it's getting a lot of traction in other areas, and there's a lot of interest in this and looking at this as the ACO model. In addition, I think we can learn from the CCDS as we move to implement total cost of care arrangements. Some of the lessons that were learned were documented by the University of Minnesota Academic Health Center, and this was just released in April, and many of you may have seen it. But I think a few of the points that were indicated, and I think Representative Murphy stated some of these earlier, are worth reiterating as we go forward. I think all of the partners that were involved with CCDS indicated that freedom, and I'm stating this right out of the document, freedom and flexibility are needed, and all systems are confident and help them when designing their eventual ACO. A lesson learned from Hennepin County was funding was the dark side of the whole program. There are clear learnings on patient experience and total cost of care, but there is no reward for this innovation. If a health system is funded to align the care in a new model, it can work. North Memorial indicated providers must not be expected to take on insurance risk, adverse selection, catastrophic, or stop-loss claims. Providers do not possess the necessary infrastructure to administer insurance products. A third-party administrator should be selected to take on underwriting, claims processing, benefit determination, and member services. So I think as we move forward, the key here is flexibility, and we need to allow the plans and the providers to do what we do best in Minnesota, and that's collaborate to provide high-quality care and bend the cost curve in the right direction, we hope. We believe that that is the intent of the chairman and the committee in pursuing the choice waiver, and we appreciate those efforts. I'll turn over to Mr. Barsh.
Yeah, Mr. Barsh, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Barsh. I represent Medica, and I'm also today offering some comments on behalf of the other nonprofit health plans. I don't want to repeat a lot of what's been said because there's a lot of good work that's being done and a lot of commonality in terms of where everyone is trying to move this system forward. I would just like to remind folks that there was a piece of the budget agreement that passed last year that allowed for the Department of Human Services to develop some demonstration projects to do much of what we're talking about today. It's 256B.0755. But it is a really actually interesting move forward to develop demonstration projects around total cost of care, putting providers in sort of the lead role of care coordination. The department issued an RFI about this maybe a couple months ago, and those responses are back. I would encourage everyone who's interested in this to go to the department's website and read the respondents. They got around 30 of them from health plans, from providers, from the community clinics, from other organizations. And they're very well thought out in terms of not only where people want to see the system move, but also a willingness to step up and do some of that work or take some of that work on. Some common themes that you would find in those responses, which are similar to what you're hearing here, is a need to engage in payment reform and really to do some of those things that you've heard about today, which is put some incentive in place for providers whereby if they're being more efficient, they actually see some of the gains in that. The second would be patient assignment or patient attribution, knowing who is in your total cost of care plan or having a little more leverage to work with some of your patients to help them understand where you want them to seek most of their services. And then another piece, obviously, is data sharing that goes along with both of those so that providers have the total knowledge base of information about the utilization of the patients that they are now responsible for serving. And I think there's a lot of good work that is being done in the commercial marketplace to move in that direction. I think what we're seeing in the RFIs is a lot of momentum and willingness from people to do that type of work in the public programs arena as well, and that's encouraging. So a couple of things to take away from that. One is when we're looking to seek waivers from the federal government, we want to make sure that we're seeking flexibility from the federal government where we need it to do better. But much of what we want to do, we could do without the allowance from the federal government, or actually sooner than what it might take to seek a waiver. And a key thing to take away from that is if and as we're looking to solve the budget deficit, and as you, Mr. Chairman, and others are looking to get savings out of the system, we want to make sure we're aligning the cuts that are being made with the direction that all of us are trying to move, which again goes to the issue of flexibility. If it's a 10% savings you're seeking from the system, allow us to align that reduction along with some of the momentum we're moving around payment reform so that a 10% reduction isn't just a 10% reduction, but possibly a 10% reduction with the ability to gain some of that back through efficiency. And I think a lot of what's in the proposed choice waiver or what's in the language that passed last year, and more importantly, what's happening in conversations already between payers and providers in the marketplace, is trying to move us in that direction. So again, just to reiterate some of the comments, encouragement to move in this direction as quickly as possible is obviously needed, but so is the flexibility for all of us to work together to do it in a way that best meets the specific needs of not only the payers and the providers, but also the patient populations that are going to be served by a new model of care.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. And I think part of what this is about is expediting that RFI process on the pilots, but also I think moving it back into the public arena a little bit. I think that what Ms. Mason was talking about input and so on, things moving into the department, you don't know what happens there, and out comes a plan, and, you know, it's nothing against that. That's how we manage our state, but I think at this point there's an interest on our part to be involved. I see the collection of us in a bipartisan way as kind of being the board of directors about how we establish our policy. And I think the will in 2007 with the transformation stuff and the 08 reforms and all, we're kind of like, it was a nice idea. Like, I mean, this is something to move toward. And well, now we're all like desperate. And I think that the fear factor has increased by tenfold on everybody's angle. And we've seen good things and scary things happen with the intervening projects, CCDS and GAMC, and proposals going forward and saving money and ideas that make sense and don't make any sense. And so how do we actually make it all land? And then also, just to remind us, the department has a target $1 billion below what our target is at, which gives them a more comfortable direction to take their time at. And if that becomes a real target, which is a topic of a discussion far beyond this room, decided by people, you know, above my pay grade here, if that comes true, we're just in a whole different spot. And so that's the purpose of the meeting, and I appreciate your engagement, and I... I think this has been very productive and a really good start. Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Barsh, the pilots you're talking about, were those the Hennepin County, Ramsey County pilots?
Mr. Barsh.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, in our commercial populations, there's a lot of work that's underway. I wouldn't even call them pilots. I mean, we've been engaged in total cost of care payment arrangements for years now. 70% of Medica's members in the metro area are served by providers who are under a total cost of care contract. I think when we're talking about pilots in the Medicaid population, there's a few demonstration projects here and there with small defined populations that look at care delivery in a more global concept, meaning managing care better, et cetera. But what we haven't gotten to yet is sort of the pilot or the demonstration on how providers really come forward with their own ways to serve a Medicaid population or a specific subset of the Medicaid population under that new payment arrangement. That's the RFI that the department is moving forward on based on the legislation that passed last year.
And Mr. Barsh and Mr. Chairman, is that the thing that was in the law that was related to Hennepin and Ramsey County?
Mr. Chair and Representative Huntley, no, it was a different. One of those was Section 69, one of them was Section 70, and other people referred to them in that manner before.
Representative Huntley, that's good. Well, I think we're going to wrap up this segment, unless there's other questions. Representative Murphy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
How did I pick you? I don't know, just randomly.
Well, I had the smile on my face. I just wanted to, maybe shape my thinking around your comment about here we are and now we're desperate in 2007 and 2008. The ideas in the document that we see here aren't really all that, they're not all that new. They are ideas that have been bouncing around here for a number of years, and there are a number of reasons why we haven't been able to move forward on this. And some of it's the community and some of it's our own inability or unwillingness to move forward, right? What I am a little worried about is there have now been, it feels like, a number of occasions at which we've been, placed in a point of decision-making that is crisis-like. Instead of, making decisions in a more thoughtful way. And when I think about the veto of GAMC 2 years ago, that is a good example of that, right? And I think where we are now is in some ways not a result of our unwillingness to reform, but of a more entrenched underlying perspective of our politics. Right, and about what we think of Minnesotans who are at the lower rungs of the economic ladder and where they fit in and how hard it is to make their care affordable. So I just want to make sure that we are diagnosing correctly how we got to where we are today. And it isn't just about... an unwillingness to move forward with reform, because there's been a lot of willingness, I think, around this idea.
I think we're agreeing, and I hope you sense from at least me as chair and the people I deal with on both sides of this table that we all have a lot of respect for the population. But somebody said you need $1 billion of new money to build reform. I think you need a $1 billion deficit to drive people to be interested to come to the table. And so in my interest, I think, as yours is if it's the right idea, we finally caught up to it, then, congratulations to waiting it out, and it's going to happen. And, but I think in our moves, we want to make sure we move wisely and prudently, which is the purpose of the day. And I think it's been a productive discussion, and I'm open to all ideas. This is, in my mind, not a partisan exercise. This is, and if we can, I said before, I'll even broaden it out. If you get the normal hospitals, whatever that is, including Regions and Hennepin and all, along with the children's specialty ones and the HMOs, maybe county-based as well. You get the QHCs and then the general providers that are represented by Dr. Sawyer and the MMA and the PTs and all those who have, there's a lot of providers that we need to engage in this, as well as both parties and the governor and administration. You got something that will be remarkable. And I think that if it happens yet this year, or I think that would be interesting. So, yeah, you get the last word, Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to unfortunately have to leave for a little bit myself. But yeah. I'm just kind of, with regard to that, I'm just kind of curious where all your members are, because this is pretty important stuff, and we're not the side that are saying not a penny more.
Oh.
And so, if this is going to happen without a penny more, as you started out saying in the beginning, obviously some big changes have to be made, and the members of this committee, one would think, would be the most interested in what those changes are going to be, and yet many of them, they seem to be kind of rotating in and out of the room, and very few of them seem to be here engaged in this process. So I'm just kind of wondering how you see that happening, or are they just going to do whatever the chair says ultimately?
Well, that's actually pretty way cool if they do. But have you talked to have you met my side? They don't really do that. it's in my dialogue with the Senate that we discussed different views of. But actually, there was an email glitch, and I don't think they all knew. So it's a fair point. And I if they all knew, I would be a little more unhappy. So good point. But we're all in this together, and thanks for pointing that out. Anyway, so I actually got the pastel. I was just looking at the. Anyway, the three of you. Let's move to the topic of the profits matter here. And this is not meant to be a matter of gotcha. I'm just interested in giving a little due diligence on the topic. And Mr. Masta, you can come down. And then Mr. Dr. Kluger. And then Mr. Dr. Massman as well. So the three of you can. Oh, the doctors, so the misters. Collection of misters. Messers. Welcome, messers, to the place. We've got a total of about 15 minutes for this whole topic, and so maybe just take a few minutes and tell us what's in your mind. We'll have a little dialogue. And is anybody else in the audience going to want to comment about this? This was put together relatively hastily, as we just discussed. So if you're going to just, do you think you want to testify anybody in the audience besides these three? I want to be fair here. Oh, I see a hand there. Okay. You'll get 30 seconds, Mr. Feinberg. So go ahead.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, go ahead. So take a couple minutes and tell us what's going on.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lawrence Massa, and I'm the president of the Minnesota Hospital Association, representing 145 hospitals and 17 healthcare systems across the state of Minnesota. And I would like Jerry and Greg to introduce themselves as well.
I'm Jerry Massman. I'm the CFO for Children's Hospitals and Clinics.
I'm Greg Klugertz. I'm the Chief Financial Officer at Centricare Health System in St. Cloud Hospital.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here this morning. I was asked to be here to discuss the financial state of Minnesota's hospitals, especially in light of recent news articles highlighting average hospital margins. I'm pleased to report that, generally speaking, Minnesota's hospitals were in the black and able to have positive margins in 2009 and, based on preliminary information, in 2010 as well. Not long ago, during the dramatic economic upheaval in 2008, hospitals struggled to stay in the black. You may be thinking to yourself, why does a not-for-profit hospital need to have a margin anyway? Of our 145 members, all but two are either not-for-profit or government-owned institutions. A positive margin is necessary to ensure access to capital, to fund replacement of facilities and equipment, to invest in new technology and services, and to train, recruit, and retain the highly skilled workforce necessary to deliver the care needed throughout the state. as not-for-profit organizations, the margins generated by hospitals are available for reinvestment into caregivers, the physical assets, and the community benefit services that deliver the care our residents need today and in the future. Margins are not generated or used for distributions to shareholders, as would be the case in a for-profit margin. Returning to a more financially stable environment resulted from two things: the stock market recovery, which helped hospitals' investments, and from difficult but necessary cost reductions in hospital operations. One without the other would not have been enough. And because hospitals and health systems often support much of the healthcare delivery system outside of the hospital, from primary care clinics, nursing homes, ambulances, and hospices, those recoveries over the past 2 years have allowed hospitals to keep those beneficial services available in our communities. This morning, I want to hopefully clarify a few things briefly. First, I need to stress that just because hospitals as a whole had positive margins does not mean that individual hospitals are each doing well. Just as the recession hit different areas of the state, different businesses, and different families with varying degrees of hardship, it also hit hospitals differently, and some are still hurting. The median margin in 2009 was 3.2%. Median meaning half of the hospitals had a margin of less than 3.2%, half had more. 2010, based on preliminary numbers, looks like it would be a little bit better than that. But it's also important to point out that almost 25% of our hospitals lost money in 2009. So when looking at overall statistics, I would ask people to remember that within those aggregate averages are individual organizations that are struggling to do their best with the resources they have available. It's also important for me to clarify that when a hospital earns a margin, it is from privately insured patients or its investments, not from state or federal government. Government payers, Medicare, Medical Assistance, Minnesota Care, GAMC, CCDS program, which have made up a growing part of a hospital's patient mix, all pay below cost for actually delivering the care. The payment rates for state public programs are set by a formula that starts at 2002 costs and then subtracts multiple rate cuts. The negative margin for state programs is inevitable. So for all the losses hospitals suffer from government underpayment, they have to make up the differences by recouping higher payments from health plans on their commercial business. In other words, when Medicare and Medicaid underpay, it gets passed along as a hidden tax to health plans and employers. This cost shift of more than $800 million is getting more and more difficult to sustain. As the author of one of the studies featured in the media story noted, Alan Baumgarten, the average hospital in Minnesota barely breaks even on its patient revenue. Instead, margins in 2010 were generally coming from improved returns on hospitals' investment income. Finally, I want to describe how hospitals make decisions under the financial pressures they face. Like any other business, hospitals have good years and tough years. Hospital boards are charged with the fiduciary responsibility of being good stewards of the organization's resources and sustaining the mission of the organization in the long run. Margins are used to fund capital improvements and other investments to further the organization's mission. Margins are also used to show potential lenders, like banks and bond rating agencies, that our hospitals deserve favorable credit ratings with lower interest charges so hospitals can finance the capital improvements necessary to ensure that they will be viable, ready, and equipped to meet the community's health care needs well into the future. And some hospitals use their margins to put into savings and invest so they can weather those tough years when revenues aren't enough to make ends meet. When the tough years come around, keeping the doors open 24/7, especially our emergency rooms, is the single highest priority for hospitals. We need positive margins to make that happen. When there are cuts in government payments, when there are reductions in Medicare rates, when investment income takes an unexpected jump off the cliff, hospitals respond by doing what they need to do to keep their doors open. They eliminate services that may not be essential, as essential, or mission critical. They end some community benefit programs that otherwise would help hold down costs in the long term, but are cut to stem the bleeding in the short term. And they look for ways they can be more efficient. In other words, they try to do the same with less, or they figure out how to do less with less, so they can keep those doors open and give people the access to the care that they need. To sum up, we feel the margins reported in the 2010 report represent prudent financial stewardship of critical resources that provide access to high-quality, effective care throughout our state. Positive margins allow reinvestment in significant infrastructure that have made Minnesota providers national leaders in care delivery. And I would be happy to ask my counterparts if they would like to share anything, or we would open it up to questions from the committee.
Well, maybe if they would comment just briefly, we've got about 7 minutes left altogether. If they could just comment on what, like the children's specialty thing and the systems. I understand some of the ones that are side tied to clinics had greater losses, and maybe you could just, the two of you could comment on what, about those 25% who lost money, what kind of hospitals are those? So you want to just tackle that general?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the 25% that lost money would include hospitals in the metropolitan area, like North Memorial Medical Center, as well as hospitals in rural communities. So there really isn't a one-size-fits-all. And I really think that that's our message, is that the one-size-fits-all is a very dangerous approach when you have this kind of thing.
Well, why don't the two of you offer your comments? Go ahead.
In that light, the point, Mr. Chairman, is that one size doesn't fit all. Obviously, I think you understand the importance of profitability being the engine that provides the cash flow needed to make routine capital replacements and to invest in providing services. Children.
Maybe just lean to the microphone a little bit. Maybe you'll cover up the static.
Okay, sorry about that. Children's in 2010 was barely profitable. There were two major reasons for that. One is a drop in volume attributable to decline in birth rates and the effect of the economy. And the second was the growth in our medical assistance payer mix, which over the last decade has increased from 22% to currently 42%, as Dr. Goldblum indicated. The other thing I would mention around profitability, you need to also appreciate that if we're not able to, as a result of our reliance upon Medicaid, if we're not able to continue to generate a profit margin, what we put at risk is approximately $70 million of charity care and other community benefits. Now, a good portion of that is the underfunding of, obviously, medical assistance. But without an adequate profit margin, we will need to look at, and this is not meant to be a threat, just a reality, that as we look to, obviously, remain financially viable, we then need to begin to look at what programs that are not able to fund themselves, can those programs be cut back or eliminated? It's not something we want to do. It's not our mission. Our mission, obviously, is to serve every child that presents, as well as to offer services, much-needed services, in terms of promoting the health of children in Minnesota, which could be at jeopardy.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, and Mr. Kluger, do you want to talk for a minute on the state of St. Cloud, and not just, I mean, on the status of St. Cloud, and what your Centric Care is, how they're doing?
Mr. Chairman, members of the community, St. Cloud Centric Care operation has built a legacy of excellent service on an excellent economic foundation. We continue to perform at those levels. Our operating margin in 2009 was 5.44%, and the operating margin this year is operating at the same level. Part of what you've heard is about the levels, the reported levels, really is a reflection of recovery of the investment markets. In order to be able to access debt, we are called on to hold significant reserves. And when you hold significant reserves in a downturn, you suffer. And in the kind of capital market recovery in the last couple of years, we've done very well. But it's really only restoring to levels that are normal for investment-grade hospitals. You hit on a point that I'd like to use my last however long. System. Today, the relevant measurement is to know how the systems are performing. The number I gave you was our system number.
The previous discussion talked about choice and different innovations. They're dependent on systems. Hospitals of old would be relatively powerless. They'd have power, but probably not have sufficient clout to bring together all the resources necessary to intervene at the care level process. So, in fact, what is attempting to be done is to keep people out of hospitals and relies on having nurses to intervene and physicians who are following evidence-based medicine. So, while it's interesting to report the hospital performance, to accomplish what we need to be cognizant of system performance. So, I think you're entirely right. When you measure system performance, inevitably that means bringing physicians in. The reality of today's reimbursement algorithms is such that hospitals are doing relatively well in the commercial area, and physicians, professional practitioners, not just physicians but all professional practitioners, not so well. As a result, most systems operate physician practices, provider practices, at losses. And so the system numbers are almost universally less than hospitals.
Okay, Ms. Webson-Kiffmeyer has a question, and Mr. Feinwachs will actually only get about 30 seconds. So why don't you do that, and then we're going to wrap it up. So go ahead, Webson-Kiffmeyer. Mr. Feinwachs, you want to come down while there are questions going?
Thank you very much, gentlemen, for being with us today and giving us those insights. One of the comments that was made was changing some of your programming. But one of the things I know from being on a hospital board is that frequently we would reassess the needs of our community, and we would close some programs and open up new ones because we would have new ways. There was like the sleep clinic or pain clinic, things that before were just a part of a practice. So I just wanted to comment that just because something is closed doesn't always mean that is a bad thing, because sometimes you open up something else that serves better or meets the greater current need or done in a different way. And I think I know that time is short and we got to get to Mr. Feinwachs, but maybe in the future you could just also talk about some of those changes that are also relevant. And thank you for being here today.
Thanks. I guess I'll take that as a comment. And I want to thank you for coming, and you can be excused if you like. At least create room for Mr. Feinwachs to sneak in there. And I was only kidding about the 30 seconds, but that's how it turned out, and it wasn't intentional. So we want to give you the most respectful 30 seconds we can possibly give you, Mr. Feinwachs. So thank you for coming to the committee, and I know you're here special just for this, so welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. My name is Dave Feinwachs. I represent no one, and my views are my own here. I simply want to draw your attention to the following. Nonprofit hospitals and nonprofit health plans in Minnesota both make a profit. They need a profit to sustain themselves, and that is a fact. What is interesting is what I will suggest to you is the hospital health plan paradox, that hospitals make their profit for commercial business and health plans make their profit almost exclusively from the management or operation of state and government programs. If you want to have serious health care reform, if you want to understand the system, if you want to change anything, you have to understand the hospital health plan paradox. The key to the hospital health plan paradox is the analysis and use of real-time encounter data to understand how services are delivered and who is being compensated for what. The key to that understanding is the use of independent financial auditors to examine that data and report to you, the legislature, and other policymakers what exactly is happening. Then you can reform the system. Then you can try alternative models. Thank you.
That was pretty respectful, I think. And then just thank you for that. And maybe to the Hospital Association, if they could give us, it seems like the investments have rebounded, which probably is helping to bump up those numbers. I remember in the past you've been given some numbers about investments versus operating, and I think that would be productive, and so it would help the reporting to be, I think, fair, and I think that's what my takeaway on this today is. And I meant this to be just a little passage over the topic, just in light of the news, and we were here. The big topic we did today was this work on this pushing forward reform of the 07 nature for Representative Murphy, or the current version of it. But I think there's a lot of interest in that, and I think it's going to move forward one way or the other. With that, we did. How about that? I'm pretty happy. There's a conference committee this afternoon sometime. Stay tuned. We're adjourned. Thank you.